On December 29, 2004, the governments of Canada and the United States implemented the Safe Third Country Agreement. This agreement effectively closes the door on most refugees seeking to make a claim at the U.S.-Canada land border. Since 1990, over 131,000 refugee claims were made at the land border. Most of those claimants were found to be refugees in need of protection, and many are now Canadians. But for most refugee claimants who try to follow the same route today, the Safe Third Country rule means that they will be rejected by Canada without ever being able to present their refugee claim or explain why the U.S. is not safe for them. The Canadian Council for Refugees has just produced a report on the first year of the Safe Third Country Agreement. Janet Dench is Executive Director of the Council. She joins me on the line this morning from Montreal. Hello, Janet.
Hello.
Could you explain what has been the effect on the number of refugees coming to Canada just in 1 year?
There's been a very dramatic decrease in the number of claimants that we've seen in 2005, and this followed on from a trend since 2001 when we had a very high number of claimants, but since then it's been going gradually, or quite quickly in fact, down. And the decrease continued in 2005 after the implementation of the Safe Third Country Agreement, but was particularly acute at the land border, as we could expect, because, of course, the Safe Third Country Agreement particularly affects people who are trying to make a claim at that border. In fact, it only affects them there.
Are there any countries that have been particularly affected?
Well, we highlighted in our report the situation of Colombians. In 2004, Colombia was the top country of source country for claimants in Canada. So they had the most to lose because they were the largest group that was coming to make a claim, coming to make claims in Canada. But they were also particularly affected because Colombia, of course, being in the Americas, the way to come to Canada almost inevitably is through the United States. And in fact, in 2004, 97% of Colombians made their claims at the land border. So when that land border is largely closed to claimants, it has a devastating impact on the ability of Colombians to find protection in Canada.
What are your concerns for these people who didn't make the refugee claims in Canada?
Our number one concern is that by sending them back to the United States, by insisting that they make their claims in the United States, we are not making sure that they are they have the safety that they need. We quite acknowledge that many refugees do find protection in the United States. We don't argue with that. But what we do know is that many people who need protection do not find it in the United States. So by forcing people to go back to or remain in the United States, we're forcing some people to face situation either where they are detained and returned to Colombia or their other home country, or and this we know is the situation for many people, are living without status in the United States in continual fear of being caught and detained and deported.
And so they're not able to get status in the U.S., but because they went to the U.S., they're not able to apply anywhere else.
Well, if you're in the United States, what are your options? If you are a Colombian, there are very large numbers of Colombians in the U.S. Rather few of them actually claim asylum because they fear that making an asylum claim will not do anything good for you, for them, and in fact will bring them to the attention of the authorities and eventually lead potentially to them being deported back to Colombia. The reason for their concerns are based on some concrete facts. If we look at the acceptance rates, whereas in 2004 the acceptance rates for Colombians in Canada was over 80%, in the United States the highest acceptance rate in one of the stages was 45% acceptance. So we can see that the claims are being dealt with in different ways. Also, in the United States, they have a rule that says, generally speaking, you can't make an asylum claim if you've been in the U.S. for over a year. And what happens to many people is that they come to the U.S., they find some initial safety because they're out of Colombia, but they either don't know how to make a refugee claim, or they don't have the money because there's no legal aid, so they're trying to settle down enough to get enough money to pay for a lawyer. They may get bad advice. There's little really to give people clear information about their opportunities. So often you're dealing, when people do eventually come to somebody, a lawyer or an NGO that might be able to give them advice, they've already been in the U.S. for over a year, and so are probably not going to be able to make an asylum claim.
Immigration law has also changed in the United States recently. What changes have there been there?
Well, when the Safe Third Country Agreement came into effect, we already criticized it for the fact that U.S. is not necessarily a safe country for refugees. But since it came into effect, things have got, as you say, worse for refugees. There has been a new piece of legislation that was passed in May of 2005, something called Real ID, which, among other impacts, changes some of the rules for those people making refugee claims in the U.S. And what we find particularly shocking is the total indifference of the Canadian government, apparently, is from what we've seen. They have not been able to give any sign that they have actually studied this new legislation, examined the impact, thought about whether the Safe Third Country Agreement continues to be appropriate in their view with this new piece of legislation, which in our mind simply confirms what we have always believed, which is that the Canadian government doesn't really care about what the impacts of the agreement are on people who are denied protection in Canada, that their main goal is to reduce the number of people who can make a refugee claim in Canada.
You've pointed out that one of the most challenging aspects of raising awareness of the human cost of this agreement is that these people never actually reach Canada. Are they becoming invisible to us?
They are largely invisible, even to those of us who are quite close to this issue, who have been trying to find out information, who work in the refugee sector, because people who don't have security, for one thing, they stay in the shadows. They don't want to draw attention to their situation. So we know that there are many people that are in the U.S. That are living lives in the margins, and they are very frightened of coming forward, of talking about their situation, because they fear that anything they may do or say that draws attention to them may simply mark them out and lead to further troubles for them in the United States. And this situation has got dramatically worse in the last little while, because there is a new bill that is being discussed in Congress, which says that it would basically make it a crime to be without status in the United States. So there's a lot of rumors and fear going around the affected communities in the U.S. And people, one lawyer I talked to in the U.S. said that for the first time she had people calling her up who said, "I'm afraid even to be talking to you," because they had so much got the impression that the laws and government in the United States was turning against them, and that anything they might do could put them at greater risk.
Does the Canadian government take any responsibility for the people that are turned away at the border?
No, we have raised this with the Canadian government. We had a meeting in November to talk about the impacts of the Safe Third Country Agreement, and we told them what we felt was happening and some of the information we have, and we asked them what they were doing to monitor the impacts, and basically they washed their hands of it. They said, well, there's nothing we can do, there's no way we could find out. One particular thing, for example, we were asking about was about the impact on women fleeing gender-based persecution, because it is well established that in Canada it is quite clear what the law says in terms of making sure that women fleeing gender-based persecution deserve protection. In the United States, the law is very unclear, and so how you get treated may be a matter of luck in the United States. So that was clear, and it was clear to the government, and the Canadian government itself acknowledged that there could be differential impacts for women because of this problem in the United States. And they told the Standing Committee, the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Citizenship and Immigration, who had raised this concern, they said, well, we'll have to monitor the impacts of the agreement. And that's in their formal report, which is available on the on the government website. That's one of their commitments. When we asked about that, it was clear that they had done absolutely nothing to monitor the impacts on women, and it apparently is not a concern for the government.
Have you any indication from refugees on, as to how they understand the nature of this agreement?
Well, that's I guess it's a very general question. One of the problems is that there is little information that's out there. The government has changed the rules and has not felt that it needed to communicate with the affected people the new rules and how they would apply. A striking example of this is that the rules say that if you come from a moratorium country, that's a country that Canada does not generally deport to, that you are exempted from the Safe Third Country Agreement. But how are you supposed to know whether there is such a moratorium on removal to your country? There is nowhere on the Canadian immigration website that tells you what the list of countries are. So you have to somehow find that out indirectly. So there's very little information, and one of the things we report on in our one-year report is the degree to which there is misinformation, not only among, or lack of information, not only among the people affected, but even the people that are giving them advice. So you'll find people, even immigration lawyers and organizations that are offering advice and counseling to immigrants who don't know, don't understand properly some of the basic provisions in the agreement. So that that adds to the problems that people face. A particular example of that was a very troubling story of a young boy who came up because his mother was in Canada, and he came up, he was in the company of his grandmother who was bringing him up to join his mother. He made a claim because people felt like, well, he would be entitled to make a claim because his mother was in Canada. In fact, his mother was a refused refugee claimant, and on that basis, the boy was not eligible under Safe Third, and he was returned to the United States. So here you have a boy who is separated from both of his parents. His mother is on one side of the border, he is on the other side of the border, and he ended up spending months before eventually his mother actually did get approval in principle to stay in Canada, and eventually he was able to come back and be reunited. But he spent months separated, and this was a boy that had already been traumatized by very difficult circumstances in his life, and there's no way of telling really what the long-term costs will be for that family, for that young boy.
You, along with both Amnesty International and the Canadian Council of Churches, have launched a legal challenge of the agreement. What basis are you challenging it on?
Well, there's several legal grounds, but a key one is on the basis of the Charter. The Canadian Charter applies to anybody who is on Canadian territory, and it should apply and does apply to someone who is knocking at our door and asking for our protection. And so what we are arguing is that the Safe Third Country Agreement violates the Charter provision, the guarantee of the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, because somebody who is sent back to the United States without any examination of their particular circumstances may face a violation of those basic rights. We're also making the argument that it is counter to the Charter Protection of Equality, Section 15, which is the non-discriminatory clause, because we see that the Safe Third Country Agreement does have different impacts on certain groups. We are, most of us, I'm sure, familiar with the fact that Muslims and Arabs who face discrimination also, of course, in Canada, but particularly in the United States and in U.S. Immigration procedures, as an Arab or Muslim man, you are particularly likely, for example, to be detained. And once you're in detention, also, I find it much more difficult to win refugee protection. Also, as I mentioned, women fleeing gender-based persecution don't have the same protections in the U.S. as they might have in Canada. So we are arguing that the agreement is contrary to these principles of non-discrimination protected under the Charter. We also will be referring to Canada's international human rights obligations, because Canada is a signatory to the Refugee Convention, and under that convention, we are obliged not to send any refugee back directly or indirectly to face persecution. And we would be violating that, we are violating that obligation if we send someone back to the United States who in turn is sent back to face persecution, then we are indirectly sending someone back to face persecution.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me, Janet.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I've been speaking with Janet Dench, Executive Director of the Canadian Council for Refugees. Their report is titled Closing the Front Door on Refugees and is available on their website, web.net/CCR. This is Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.